Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? It is Tuesday, June 18th, 2019, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 241, the one where we are all still jet-lagged. I'm your host, Austin Walker. Joining me today was the laughter of Kato on the ones and twos.
Hi.
On the ones and snooze, because yeah, I'm tired.
Sleepy.
Sleepy as hell.
Why is it? What time is it in the West Coast? It's
eight.
Nine. Eight. I can math. See, eight. That's how bad it is.
That's how bad it is. That's how bad it is. Also joining us from the Midwest, Patrick Klepek, about to go back to Los Angeles tomorrow.
Yeah, you know, I didn't get enough. I'm just gonna help. I'm gonna take my whole family back to the Los Angeles Convention Center and just we'll see what's there. What's
you're
left?
You're checking on that casino for us?
Let's actually see.
Have you gotten a response yet?
Los Angeles Convention Center.
What's going on?
There's gotta be something there this week, right?
Probably.
Take them back to Shaquille's now that I'm a regular?
No, don't go back. let's see. LAV's Convention Center, the calendar.
Shaquille's not cheap. I just did the expenses for that dinner.
That dinner was expensive.
Yeah.
Let's see. Where is this? I don't want to view calendar.
Calendar right here. Right here. What day is it? Today is the 18th?
Ooh, yeah. All right, so Friday.
Oh, holy shit.
Alien Con 2019 and also the BET experience. You know, two great flavors
mashed together. Honestly, I would fuck around and go to Alien Con in the morning and the BET experience at night.
Yeah.
That seems like the play.
Sounds like a good
day. Put my kid down and be like, all right, I got that Nest Cam on. I'm going to leave you at the hotel. You're good, Jessica.
$625 for the Cosmic Pants Pass. Not the Cosmic Pants. The Cosmic Pass.
Does it come with pants?
Our enhanced Alien Con experience features a lot of special perks. Cosmic Pass holders receive guaranteed general admission.
Yo, this is not, let's be clear. This is not for the Fox proper Disney property Alien.
No. Nope.
This is an Alien Con, as in when you pay $625. You get an exclusive session with the stars and creators of Ancient Aliens.
With the dude from Ancient Aliens from that meme. That I'm dead ass serious.
$625.
Right,
that's him. The cosmic guy.
Let me tell you some of the great things you get for $625. For example, an exclusive preview of the Alien Con schedule.
Shut the fuck up.
What?
How much is listed at the bottom?
What? So can you not see?
Exclusive.
You can't see what the schedule is.
You get a calendar invite early.
Let's look at the guests here.
William Shatner, of course.
Of course.
Yeah. Of course.
Of course.
My man shows up.
Makes sense.
Yeah, we
still
got
complaining about not being in those new Star Trek movies.
Is he? Is that a thing he's been doing?
Oh, he's for years. He considered it a personal slight that Nimoy was in the reboot, and he was not, and like would just complain about it publicly in every interview.
Wow.
Damn.
Wow.
Gotta stay relevant.
I gotta tell you, there's a lot of people here who are listed as ancient civilization experts.
Okay.
Ancient civilizations technological experts, and I'm skeptical.
Yeah.
Because I know how many of the people who walk in this field of expertise are just like, well,
I'm going all the way down to the bottom.
Who Stan Lee was mentioning when he said true believers?
Yeah, this is what he meant.
Okay, right.
First people.
Brown people could not have built the pyramids. Too advanced for them.
Fuck!
Definitely aliens. And let me be clear, I believe in aliens.
Me too. I don't know what form.
Skip, I would like
if
to.
If there are alloys, but
aliens are like brothers to me. But I believe the Egyptians built the pyramids using an array of technologies that were already available at the time. I'm going to get to the bottom of this.
You know what? Honestly, can Stephen A. Smith just stop talking about sports and just talk about everything else?
Everything else.
If he had a talk show that was just a general purpose, like...
Just a call-in show where you could ask him about any topic.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd be like, I'll be right back. I got to check Wikipedia. That would be great. We should talk about video games, though, actually, is what we should do. We made it back from E3, which means the last thing we want to do is talk about video games. But it turns out I checked, and we have a video game podcast.
Oh, right.
So I know some people talk about other things, and like, but Evangelion's not out yet, so we can't.
Right.
We can't.
Is that this week?
It.
Am I? Is that
it's Friday?
It is
that
Friday.
This week?
It's this week.
Wow. So I just, you know, just conveniently timed my flight to be out of town when Evangelion came back, so I could avoid the discourse. Monday evening.
Okay. So we can do time for the next week. Thing.
Yeah.
We have to figure it out. Like off mic, we have to figure out what that schedule looks like and like if we can
what we can get away with.
What we can get away with is dead ass serious. It's a 26 episode show, and.
We live in a different world.
We
than
live in a different
in
world. I did the math the other day, and this time 2 years ago, there were technically 9 people working for Waypoint.
Well,
And that and
if you count all the aliens, then
it's 900.
You know, maybe still.
Yes, they're everywhere around me, Patrick. We have the clip to prove that I believe that. So we'll have to figure it out. I'm not gonna take away any promises we made, but I am gonna say everything we do, we just have to move carefully in these days.
What we can say is like we do not live in a world where we can probably spend as much time as a previous version.
This is not
in
12
no world,
episodes of Evangelion.
Well, I want to say just
only.
In no world was there ever a version of it where we were going to do like episode by episode breakdowns.
Not 26
there were like versions
episodes,
of it
no.
that we talked about like doing arcs, like packing
and that
episodes together.
It's still feasible. It's just you know,
depends on the arcs, I guess. Depends on how many we can watch in a week.
Yeah. So I'm going to do some work this week of just like putting together what that list looks like.
Yeah.
If you have very strong feelings, you know how to get in touch with us, gaming@advice.com. If you're like, no, this is the order. But please be thoughtful. Also, the discourse is just going to be so much.
Mm-hmm. What is that thing called where they re-chopped all the prequel movies?
Chainsaw? Is that what it's called?
The
machete?
Machete.
Machete,
yeah.
Not chainsaw.
Is there a machete order for the Evangelion properties?
I think it's release order, right? It has to be.
Well, but what about Rebuild? Where does that fit in?
That's not coming to Netflix, so we're good.
Oh, okay.
So
right.
We're good.
And we're also on, that's not how I want to experience it.
Yeah,
I want to experience like the original thing.
You
got to
see the original thing, for sure.
Yeah, agreed.
For sure.
Yeah.
So, Patrick, video games. Kato, video games. Are there
video games
we haven't talked about from E3 that we want to mention before we turn to the
questions? Yeah, the one that came out during E3.
Cadence of Hyrule.
Hell yeah.
Is that the one? Okay, I want to make sure.
Sure.
Yeah.
Have y'all played that?
Yes.
How much time you put into it?
6 hours, probably.
Okay.
I'm bad at that game.
Yeah? You haven't come over the hump yet and, like, found it?
I kind of have.
Okay.
But like then I also stopped and started playing Breath of the Wild instead.
Was Breath of the Wild. Yeah. I saw you make a tweet about shield surfing, so I had the feeling that maybe you were playing Breath of the Wild again.
Yes. But Cadence of Hyrule is I never played the original Crypt of the Necrodancer.
Right.
I didn't really have any idea. Like I knew it was like beat based, music based, but like I went in mostly because I had never like really looked into what Crypt of the Necrodancer exactly was.
Mm-hmm.
So first it was wrapping my head around like, oh, okay, it's like those old rogue games, but on a beat.
Uh-huh.
And everything has to happen on that beat, including like using an item or whatever, which is what I kept fucking up. I would like drop a bomb off beat and then lose streak,
your multiplier,
and then get attacked by the thing behind me because I kept trying to just drop them as if I could do that in real time wherever or whatever.
Right.
You know, small things like that where you just have to you really, really, really need to get into the cadence of every single press you're doing is on that thing.
Yeah, and also, unless
you go into the options menu, right, and then you can turn off right all of that.
Wait, did you do
so
this?
So for folks that, no, I'm okay, just, like, okay, I want to put up front, like, before we, like, front load, like,
yeah,
if you're bad at rhythm games, like, this is an inaccessible game for you, which is not true. Like, right, they eventually right added a mode for Crypt of the Necrodancer, which is also in Cadence of Hyrule, in which it basically turns it into a turn-based affair, in which every enemies don't do anything until you move. So you can essentially treat it as a turn-based strategy game.
Yeah.
You lose, which is, I think.
So then it becomes a lot of the aesthetic like stuff.
It's just a roguelike, yeah, right, at that point. It, yeah. Which right, you do. I have,
but I don't. But I know that I've read lots of people that like played enough to like wrap their head around it, enjoy the music, and then said, "Look, if I actually want to finish this thing,
right,
they were just not going to wrap their heads around the controls." And so I think like it's a totally. I just wanted to make sure like upfront that like. Because I've seen it like mentioned on Twitter, but I feel like it's lost because maybe in some way it's sort of like not the way to play the game.
Right.
And I do think like there's like the pitch of the game is playing on rhythm, playing with the music. I think that's part of what makes it like wholly unique.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also just another option if you get 8 hours into this and go, it's either I do that or I stop playing it. Because I've read lots of people had satisfying sort of, you know, conclusions with the game. Turning on that mode that turns it into more of a traditional rogue style game.
Yeah, I kind of bounced off the original Necrodancer because the thing that appealed to me was the rhythm stuff. But then I started playing it. I was like, this is not how I like to play roguelikes. And if I want to play a roguelike, I have so many other roguelikes I want to play. So I don't just want to turn off this one thing that makes it really special. I have like a really hard time. I had a really hard time with Crypt of the Necrodancer because the thing I love about roguelikes is being able to pause and be like, okay, what do I have at my disposal? And this isn't to judge the game and be like, this is a bad game. Like, in fact, what I've come to kind of understand, especially having gone now through also like 5 or so hours of Cadence of Hyrule, is like, oh, okay, there is. The enemy design is, I don't want to say it's simple, but it's working on an axis that does not require that same degree of complete pausing. And what it does require is an understanding of their rhythms because they also move on beat.
Right.
But they don't always move. It's not like for every step you take, they take a step. It's that for every step you take or for every beat that plays, they
can do an action.
They're doing an action. And some of their actions take a few beats to trigger, right? So like you'll have someone who like there's a jumping spider that like charges a jump, then like leaps up and then lands or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You'll have characters that throw spears, and so they're like charging up the spear, then throwing it, and then it marks where it's going to land on the next turn. And so like beginning to internalize those rule sets, looking at a screen and being like, okay, here is how I can operate given what enemies are on this one screen. Like, okay, I got 2 jumping spiders, I got one of those lizards that's going to fucking charge me, and I got a spear throwing cyclops guy, you know, like, I'm like, okay, how do I deal with them?
Yeah.
Is actually really, really fun, and I've actually had a pretty good time with Cadence of Hyrule so far. I don't know if I'm going to stick with it all the way through, because there's already so much on my plate I want to play right now.
Yeah.
But I really had a good time with it over the weekend, and I hear it's not that long. Patrick, how far into it are you at this point?
I'm like 3 hours. Like, I'm so close to the end of like Steam World Quest that
yeah.
I keep getting pulled away to like chip away at a chapter there, and I'm finally at the last two. But I played a couple hours. One of the things that I found more appealing about So I, like you, I didn't really bounce off Crypt of the Necrodancer as much as I played it and was like, cool, I'm going to come back to this, and just didn't, like a you know billion other games, but really loved what it was trying to do. I also think I played it in early access, and I tend to avoid early access games because also, like everyone here, I have a million things to play, and so I would rather wait till a developer says,
yeah.
cool, like yeah. we're ready. And so then by that time, I just never quite got back to it. But if I remember correctly, like that one was a little more... Like, so Cadence of Hyrule has, like, a world map in which there are lots of points that you can warp between. So that, and you can have very specific objectives that you're going after. It is not strictly that, you're going, like, down levels and fighting bosses along the way, and then there's a final boss, and you got to survive all that gauntlet in order to make progress. Like, if you've, you know, played Spelunky, it's like, yeah, you can travel between areas, but really, if you're doing a run at that game, you need to go through each individual area, make sure you're powering up, making sure you're getting money, and really warping ahead is only to study, like, enemy behavior and get a better sense of that area. So when you do a real run, it's you have a better sense of what to do and you're not surprised. Whereas in Cadence, if I Rule, at least in like the 3 hours I've played, it's actually like, hey, you can go talk to this witch who will like put a glowing icon on your map that's like, hey, yeah, go do this thing. And you can keep warping to like, let's say, two spaces before and go figure out what that thing is to do, which may lead you to a dungeon, which may lead you to an item. And I've enjoyed that part of it because as much as I have in my relationship with roguelikes is sort of hit or miss. Some get me, and then others I find like frustrating to a degree that I just kind of bounce off them. And I think maybe that was part of it with Crypt of the Necrodancer, where at some point, like the rhythm part actually got annoying, and I was like, I'd rather just play like a normal platformer that just like lets me do what I want to do in like in the play. Whereas in Cadence of Hyrule, it's like, okay, cool. Like, I just want to go do the Lost Woods again. Like, just whoop back, do the Lost Woods again. And yes, you may not start out with a full suite of equipment, but even your base level stuff starts getting better. Like, you may, like, for example, like, you start with a dagger, or if you're playing as a Zelda, that's who I've primarily been playing as
same,
right now.
Same.
You have a dagger that does attack only at close range, so the square has to be right next to you. But then, like, pretty early on, you can use diamonds, which are permanent currency, to buy a spear. And the spear lets you hit for one damage from two squares away, which really just like transforms your ability to both play defense and offense and like clear out enemies in a way that it feels much more safe. And that you get that back every single time you go in. That spear doesn't break. And so you get little things like, or your health, right? Like you save up diamonds, get a fourth heart, a fifth heart.
Wait. The spear is a permanent upgrade?
Yeah, all the weapons are permanent upgrades.
Shit, okay.
Yeah, they're just in
your inventory. Because the shovel...
Some weapons, some things do break.
Yeah, so items break.
Right.
But those will... Anything that breaks during a run can break.
Right.
So on top of your weapons, on top of your heart pieces, you also get torches, which either give you like literal light in the screen you're at, but also sometimes can give you views of what's around you on the world, the overworld map or a dungeon map.
You can also use it to burn.
You can also use it to burn stuff. You get shovels, which can dig through sand.
Right.
You get bombs, which you can spend, obviously. What else do you get? There's another like main item type that wears out, but I forget what it is. Regardless, you get a few of those things.
Oh, rings.
Rings. You rings. Get rings that if give you special effects.
Yeah, and you get damage, those get damage.
Right, totally. And some of them are also made of glass, which break the second you get damage, but they're also often really powerful. And there are glass weapons that you can get, and those will break, and those do not carry over.
I got some sort of glass, I don't know what it was, because it dropped, it equipped, I got hit, it broke, and I didn't even get to see what the perk was on the weapon. It just went shatter, and I was like, oh, that's cool. But at least I learned something about the game, I guess.
Yeah. It's interesting because, like, when you die and you go to that menu where you're buying things with diamonds, at first, the only ones you could probably get are the shovel or the torch. And I had to buy those every single time. So by the time I got enough diamonds to get the spear, the other option was also a heart. And I was like, the hearts are permanent, so I'm just going to grab that instead, that the spear would also stick with me run to run.
Kato, I was the same with you. I eventually just bought the spear when I had like 12 diamonds and there was nothing else for me to really buy. And I was like, oh, this thing doesn't break. That's great.
Yeah, good to know.
I wish the game had like better communicated that, because I'm with you. It doesn't make it as immediately understandable what is permanent, what is like from run to run. But yeah, like those sort of weapons. Like I just got one for Zelda that's a poison dagger.
Ooh,
so it's like, okay, I can hit them for a hit and then walk away, and I think they can get hit twice if I just let them kind of hop around. But of course you have to get up one square in, but I could see that being very useful on like a boss or something like that, where I just wanted to get in and get away. I haven't gotten that far. I'm in the middle of my first dungeon.
So I beat the first dungeon. I'm headed towards the second dungeon now. You can
Is the first dungeon always like,
no,
you,
so
my dungeon is
know,
over by the Lost Woods?
So no, so the world is the world map is a world map, and also the world map is random whenever you start a new game. So your world map and my world map are not the same world map.
Interesting.
I think
your Lost Woods are not to the bottom right.
Mine are to the direct east of the castle.
Top right.
Okay, so I think maybe it's like they're always to the east, but who knows north south? You know what I mean? I think that they're all comprised of the same building blocks. Do you know what I mean? Like it's not.
Sure.
Did you find a fairy fountain in there?
In the Lost Woods?
I found one between the castle and the Lost Woods.
I wish I had my Switch with me. Yeah. I pulled up. I did. I forget what even my first dungeon was at this point. It was like crystal. It was ice-based. I did an ice dungeon first.
Oh.
What I will say is like in my first 90 minutes of play, I got a rapier, which does two damage from two spaces away, and it steps you forward.
What?
And I just have never found anything even close to being as good as that. Yeah, I have the poison dagger now. The thing that's tough about it is that it only does one damage when you're next to somebody, but it does two if you're two steps away, and it charges you forward a spot. So, like, you do have to think about that a little bit, but I've totally internalized the spacing on that weapon at this point to where, like, it's really good. Yeah. Like, I'm having 18, 25 diamond runs where I'm just like, it doesn't even feel like, it hasn't felt good in a little while. And that's part of why I'm falling off of it, is that the itemization has not worked for me. I feel like my hope is I'm going to clear another dungeon, and along the way I'm going to get another cool tool. I mean, that's the other thing that's permanent.
I've also heard the difficulty ramps up significantly in the back half, to a degree that people were like, this feels like a certain... The way it's been, I've seen it like vaguely described as like, the tutorial section is over. And I'm like, what are you talking about?
I saw that same tweet
and I was like,
that's making me think. So this is not really a spoiler. Like, you get into the game and there are four dungeons you're supposed to clear.
Yeah.
My hunch is the four dungeons open up a back half.
Right.
And then that's when like the game really ramps up, you know, to some degree in the difficulty.
That makes sense to me. Yeah, that makes sense to me, given the pace I'm going through stuff right now, where it does not feel that tough. And I'm like, I don't know. There must be something else here. What I will say is I also really like the tools, because I remember the other stuff that sticks, which is like the same stuff that would stick in any Zelda game. Hookshot, boomerang. Right. You get those tools as you play the game. Cool. And they're actually really
neat.
They're actually really cool to play with in terms of like picking up items from a distance, or dragging yourself somewhere with the hookshot, or stunning an enemy.
Can you like pull an enemy towards you?
You can stun an enemy with the hookshot.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Or the boomerang, I want to say. Right now, I have not worked out why I would rather use the boomerang than the hookshot in certain situations. I have to go back and like test around with it. But I think that they do different things. I think like the hookshot has dragged me across to places before.
Right.
It has not done like a get over here scorpion spear yet.
Is it you can map that to any of the buttons?
Yeah, any of the face buttons. Okay. Totally. Right. Totally. But yeah, it seems cool. The music's great.
Yeah.
I you know, coming out of E3, I was like hyped up on Zelda shit, so it was like cool to go in and immediately start playing a new Zelda game. But like you, Kato, I also revisited Breath of the Wild and opened up my master mode save.
I had never done the DLC for that game. I owned it.
It's
and
good.
I was like,
it's
so
better
like,
than it.
Finally, I should just fucking do this finally.
Yeah, totally.
Now's the time.
Get yourself that motorcycle, listen.
Hell yeah.
I keep thinking about trying out the Dolphin emulated Breath of the Wild stuff, because that game just looks so good on PC.
Being able to play that at 1080p 60fps sounds,
God.
Or 4K or whatever like sounds incredible.
Yeah, I just want to see it. I just want to see it on my own screen and just like bask in it. And also, that would give me an excuse to just play through again on normal mode, whereas right now I'm playing on master, because I've beaten the game on normal mode. I've gotten most of the stuff. I sometimes load into my regular mode, save, just like go find one or two shrines I have left.
Right.
I mean, I probably have like 20 shrines left actually, but like they're so hard to find at this point because I found so many other ones.
Right.
They're like, I don't want to get a map. I don't want to like look up online where the missing shrines are or anything like that. So it's like, if I had an excuse to play through again on normal, because Master Mode is fun, but it is so hard.
It is very difficult.
It's very difficult.
The regen gets me every time. I'm like, that person's almost dead.
Same.
Oh, wait.
Yeah. But I loaded up my Master Mode save and just went to Kakariko Village and was like, I'm just going to do a bunch of weird side quests for NPCs. And just like hang out in the safe town. I don't have to fight anything. I kind of bask in the Breath of the Wild glow and move on. So that was fun.
Nice.
Was there anything else?
You know what? Give me a Switch Pro that like gives me a 60 FPS mode in that game.
100%.
Oh my God.
If that's not on the table, like, why are you making a Switch Pro? If that's not the thing.
Nintendo doesn't do shit like that though. So.
Fuck.
Yeah.
Fuck. Maybe. But come on.
I mean.
Come on.
It's definitely a come on, but...
Nintendo.
We'll see.
Like, how cool would that be to have, like, one more piece of DLC that, like, Randy Pitchford, Gearbox, Borderlands, complicated.
Uh-huh.
But I absolutely fucking love that they put out DLC for Borderlands 2 as a way to get you back into Borderlands 2 and set up some narrative hooks for 3. I think it's just, like, a smart, fun way to have people revisit a game that they really enjoyed and have a reason to go back in.
Yeah.
I wish more developers did. I understand the reasons they don't. There are probably a lot of logistical and marketing reasons to not have people playing an old, cheaper game when the new one is coming out. But damn, like, if there was some DLC that was, like, some epilogue shit that, like, what if there was some DLC, like, this winter, early next year,
yep,
that was that intro
trailer? This exact thought on the flight back.
And it ends with just, like,
with that cutscene.
Okay, like, here's the, or you get, like, a little more taste of, like, the world transformation. It says, like, all right, if you want to keep playing, you have to, you know, go back to the beginning before the cutscene was initiated and, you know, go jump back into the world. Or what if that world permanently changes, but all that's changed is just, like, the castle's moved up and you can look at that shit.
Dude,
and you can
just study it. That'd be so fucking good.
Right?
Oh, that'd be so... You could, like, try to figure out a way onto it. Oh, that'd be great.
People start data mining that thing, spoil the whole story a year before it comes out.
Love it. Can't wait. Yeah, I was thinking that same thing. Also, real quick, I did say Dolphin was the emulator. It's Cemu. It's at CEMU, not Dolphin. I think Dolphin is the Wii
one. Is Dolphin the Wii one?
I think it is, yeah. Right. I think CEMU is the one that lets you play Wii U games, maybe. I don't remember. I don't remember how the fuck that...
Sure.
Deeply illegal shit that I'm not suggesting anyone else do, but I bought that game twice.
Like, awesome. It's for preservation, baby.
Preservation and also 4K. And also,
you saw Bernie Sanders' tweet this morning. He was like, we need to preserve the history of video
games. That's what he said.
He's very interested in it.
He said, Frank Cifaldi, I'm happy with the effort you're doing. I can't do a good Sanders. I can't.
I want to hear Stephen A. Smith do a Bernie Sanders impression.
I definitely can't do that without practice. You got to give me a week. What I want to see is Stephen A. Smith do a Bernie Sanders interview. That's what I actually
yes. Oh, again,
want.
Just have Stephen A. Smith do a look. They're giving everybody late night talk
everybody
shows.
Got
right? Everyone's trying to crack the format. Give Stephen A. late night cultural.
Right.
It's going to be
right.
Problematic as shit.
It's
going to
be
a capital
terrible.
P problem.
Yes,
and we know that going into it as a culture
in many different ways. It's going to be problematic because he's going to say some bad shit. It's also going to be problematic because it's not going to be a good television show. But I'm going to love it.
It's just
the
viral
clips. Will be good.
Yes.
The clip show.
Yeah. That's what it's called.
With Stephen A. Smith.
Exactly. Man, I just watched Link do the parry on this Guardian in 60 FPS 4K. That's a good looking video game right there. Look at this. Well, that's an ad for Google phones. So that's not. I was going to show you, Kato.
I want to see it.
I'm going to show you. Give me a second here. Get ready.
How many? Jesus Christ! The frames.
The frames. They got them frames. Oh, that's
good.
Lighting. The lighting looks great.
The textures.
And this is just as Link. There's mods. You play as whoever you want now. You want to play as Ryu? You can probably play as Ryu. You want to play as Master Chief?
Wait.
I bet Master Chief is in this game now.
Stephen A. Smith? Can
is
I
Stephen
play
A.
as him?
Stephen A. Smith in Breath of the Wild yet? Probably. Anyway. More
6 years later, there's my headline. Someone adds Stephen A. Smith to Breath of the Wild.
Wow.
Oh God. Did y'all play anything else at E3 to talk about that we didn't hit on the pods?
There was this is short. It was at the Indiecade booth.
Yes.
And you might have seen it, Austin. I believe it's called the Pixel Cube.
It's like the Rubik's, it's like a big cube that lights up.
It's a square.
It's a square.
It's a square. It's like a cube that the lights on it look very similar to like a Pac-Man board. If you've ever gone to an arcade, like a GameWorks or Dave & Buster's, where they have like the really big like Pac-Mans that like fill like a whole wall.
Mm.
Like imagine like that sort of like massive like bulbs like brought down into a cube that you can kind of hold and rotate. And the demo they had there that they're just like figuring out production on is a very simple thing. It's just a maze and it has an accelerometer in there. So you like there's a little orb and you're just moving this orb around a maze, but you're physically moving this cube. And it was just really neat. And they were talking about how they've already built out like a developer API. It's going to be a Bluetooth speaker as well. The like production unit is like half the size and like the bulbs are like a much higher quality. And it just seemed really, it seemed the kind of thing I was like, yeah, like I could see this would be like a cool thing to have like in a living room when people come over is like solve this fucking electronic maze. It's just neat. There are many times where you just sit down with something and go, all right,
cool.
That's cool. And that was my takeaway from the Pixel Cube.
My Indiecade shout out is a game called Dicey Dungeons. Dicey Dungeon? Dicey Dungeons. Dicey Dungeons.
I think it's S.
It is.
I think
it's it is. It is. And that's Terry Many Cavanaugh, Dungeons. Chipzil, and Marlo Dobb, D-O-B-B-E. I think you can get a version of it from Itch.io right now. Let's see. Nope, it's gone on Itch.io. It was up on Itch.io last weekend. There was a build.
There was
of it.
Like a beta or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, it was a beta.
Right?
Yeah. That's gone now. It'll be back, I think, on Itch.io and Steam for PC later this year, I want to say. It is how to describe it. It is a roguelike, in which you play as a little dice that is going on an adventure and fighting really colorful, cool monsters, like evil wizards and like people made out of vegetables. And what else did I fight? I fought a bunch of cool shit. The mechanic is really cool. Did either of you play, because this is the thing it reminds me of, Tharsis?
Tharsis, no.
All right, so there was a game that was by, is Tharsis?
The name is familiar.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember who was on Tharsis. I want to say Zach Gage worked on it, but I don't want to give Gage full credit because I think it was a full team.
Oh, right. It was a co-partnership with the BitTrip runner folks.
Yes. Choice.
They were Gaijin Games. Now they're
Is it Choice?
Something.
Choice Provisions? Is that them?
Choice Provisions, yeah. Yes.
So it's a this is a there's a model of tabletop game, not just RPG, but like tabletop board game, in which this dice mechanic exists. And so maybe you'll remember this from somewhere if you're listening. You have, let's say at the very beginning of this game, you have two dice on your side, and you have two things in front of you. And what they say are, an attack, and then it's like sword. Right? And the sword thing has a dice icon on it, like an empty dice icon. And then there's another thing that is like, you have the other thing, which is a special ability that's called reroll. And every turn, you get to put a dice into each of those things. So you have kind of a slot, basically, on that sword that says do damage equal to the dice you put in there. So you roll your dice and say you get a five, you say you get 4, 5, 6, right? Or let's actually say you get 4, 5, 5. Well, you could put the 5 in the sword and do 5 damage. Or you have that reroll ability that says you can reroll any dice 3 times, right? So you're like, all right, let me reroll that 4 and see if I get a 6. And I'll reroll it until I get a 6. And if I don't, I'll put the 5 in. That's how it starts, right? Mm. Then as you get new equipment, you get new, more interesting abilities around that stuff. So eventually I got something that was like, hey, you can do a fireball attack that is equal to, it's like 6 damage plus it sets the enemy on fire. It sets one enemy die on fire because the enemies are also doing the same dice thing. And when an enemy's dice is on fire, they take damage if they try to play that dice. But to play my fire attack, I had to put a total of 8 points or more into that one weapon, basically. Mm. So I roll my dice, like, okay, I got 4, 3, 3. Like, shit, I can put all of those into the staff to do this attack. Or I could put it back in my sword and at least do that 4 straight up and then reroll. You know what I mean? You can start doing that stuff. The items are really, really cool. They're like, they end up being it's such a simple dice mechanic that you can end up doing a lot of really flavorful things to change up what you're like, what your character feels like. He's like, you have like a limited inventory. Sorry, you have a big inventory, but you have a limited amount that you can wield. You basically can like put a certain amount of items on your character. So like an example here from just like looking at their page, there is one that is like an elemental thing where like, oh, this thing required burning light. You can do fire damage equal to the number of points you put into this thing, but it has to be 4 or more. So if you get a roll 3, you can't fucking spend that 3 there. Mm. Or this is like a reward. You could pick one of these 3 things. You could get an electric shock, which is, hey, it does electric damage. It's actually electric plus 1 damage, but you can only put even dice in there.
Huh.
Or you get the ice shard, which is the same thing, but only with odd dice. It's kind of hard to explain, but the second you start to play it, you're like, I want this on my phone right fucking now.
Right.
Because the feeling of just like, all right, where do I put these dice? And then looking at your opponent's page and being like, okay, this opponent's really cool because they only have 1 die. I can deal with that pretty well. But then you look what their abilities are. There's like a wizard I fought where the wizard had 6 different spells, and each one was the wizard just put the die into whatever one spell was equal to that number. It was like, this spell needs a one, this spell needs a two, this spell needs a three. Right. If that wizard rolled a fucking six, I was toast, because a wizard is a wizard.
Right.
And so stuff like that, it's just like really flavorful in that way. I was also only playing like the base demo, and like there's a bunch of different characters that are going to be in the game. It just, it's like a really cool way of handling. Mm-hmm. It feels like,
do you only play one character at a time?
Yeah, you only play, at least in what I played, right, yes. Right. It reminded me in some ways, Patrick, of something like SteamWorld Quest, in that it takes a very mm-hmm. simple set of mechanics and does stuff really flavorful and like really like, not like it's an intro level game to this sort of dice rolling, but like it lays out the fundamentals so clearly that the depth can come later and you won't get scared off by a billion dice on screen at first. You know what
I
mean?
It's being deliberately designed, it sounds like, in the same way the SteamWorld Quest is, where, look, the early hours are maybe a little boring for people who know, like, what's up, but it's not being sacrificed for depth. It's being sacrificed because there are lots of people that are relatively new to these style of games. Exactly. Even if in the grand scheme of things, they're not a whole lot different than playing a JRPG any other game where you're like real, like that's what I've like learned, you know, now 15 hours of SteamWorld Quest is like, oh, okay. Like I think people think deck, people think like they hear certain terms and they get overwhelmed. But in reality, like, especially in the way these games are approaching them, it's really not dissimilar to like just assigning, you know, a skill tree to characters and other
games. Exactly. Yeah. You have the basic understanding of what that stuff is. And like, you know, you can even start thinking about decks in terms of things like active time battle or like cooldowns. Do you know what I mean? I think about something like Slay the Spire, where I know, Kata, you've been putting some time into that too, where you have something like, okay, I have this one fucking great card in my deck, but I just spent it. That means it's on cooldown. That means it's in my discard until
that
I cycle.
That ability
is on cooldown. Yeah. Right, exactly. It's like, except I can try to speed that up because maybe I have a card that lets me pull something from the discard pile and put it on the top of the deck. Maybe everything that lets me just discard a bunch of cards at once so I can kind of cycle the deck more quickly. And once you start thinking about those things in broader terms, I think two things happen. One is it is easier for you to see those same threads throughout all of a lot of this type of game design, including like, you remember a lot of video games get prototyped first as tabletop games. They'll build out a card-based version of even games that have nothing to do with cards because it's useful.
Famously a GDC session where they do the reverse, where it's an intro to game design class where it's like, take very big games that you love, and then turn them into a tabletop game to understand what like the underlying rules are that are driving the moment-to-moment.
Totally. The other thing that I think happens is interesting once you can start seeing those threads is it becomes you get a language for telling and understanding the kind of like narrative of play, where you get those exciting stories like, I just needed this one fucking card to come up so bad. I mean, this happened to me last night. I was actually playing Battletech Urban Warfare, which is the new Battletech expansion. And you know, so two nights ago, I posted a thing that was like, my fucking team is in shambles. I finished a mission. All of my two of the four mechs I had were completely destroyed. All four of my main pilots were in the med bay.
Fuck.
Two of them should have died. Like two of them, the mechs blew up. I got lucky, and they were in the med bay for 96 days and 128 days,
Jesus Christ, which
is a long time.
Yeah.
Think about like, what if you had to not go to work for 128 days? But
that sounds great.
I mean, that sounds great. But then, okay, what if we owned a small business? What if Waypoint was a small business? And there
feels
was,
like
and it was four of us. It was five of us because I have five people in my mech team.
We had nine people.
We had nine people once. Let me tell you about the cockpits. Yikes! Things went bad. I maybe made some bad decisions. People ejected. People switched merc companies.
Sorry, Danica.
You know what? Shout outs. You know what I mean? Someone should hire hashtag hire Danica. Actually, so things were looking bad. Everyone was in the med bay, and I was still paying their salaries because I'm a good person. I wasn't cutting them out. I wasn't like, fuck off, I'll hire new people when it's time to hire new people. I don't run a video game company. You know what I mean? That's not what I do. And so I'm just incurring debt. I'm just like getting closer and closer and closer to going bankrupt. And once you go bankrupt in that game, you're done.
Yeah.
Like, and then I hit this event. I got to the point where it was literally, I had a mission to do that I knew would pay my bills for a while. And that started the, I could, my mechs would be ready to go in 5 days. My bills would hit in 6 days, but my pilots wouldn't be ready for 7 days. I was like, literally couldn't send them back out. Like, wow. They wouldn't be cleared to be released.
Right.
On day four, I got an event where, or like, you know, in BattleTech, there are these random events that let you, that kind of tell background stories of like stuff happening on your ship, basically. Yeah. And in this one, two of my pilots who were still sick got mad at my character because my character was like up and about because they're the commander and they have to like go do shit.
Right.
And they're like, fuck off. We want to like do stuff. And so they were like going on races through the ship and stuff. And my options were either to encourage them to try to like get back on their feet more quickly or to say like, fuck off, listen to the doctor, stay in bed. And so I did that second one because I care about my workers. I'm not here to encourage. I'm not no crunch culture at the Waypoint mercenary group. And so they were like begrudgingly got back in bed. My character explained to them like, listen, I have some extra responsibilities that I have to take care of right now, but I need to look out for you. You get back in bed. And it bumped my med tech points up by 2, which when that happens, it changes the speed at which people heal. So it went from they would be healed the day after bills are due to they would be healed the day before bills are due. I immediately suited them up and threw them back onto the field as if I were the Golden State Warriors, maybe sending people out too soon. And they made bank for me. They didn't, no torn ACLs, thankfully, on my mech pilots. But that story worked so well for me, not just because like it wasn't just like there's a cool event. It was I understand the mechanisms of play in which the bills are coming due, the med tech points increase the speed of which I'm healing. And if I didn't understand that stuff already, then it would have just felt like a random event and I would have gone on with my life.
Sure.
But because it was like I made an executive decision to put them back in bed, they were ready to hit the road and actually work for me just in time to pay those bills. And that's one of the reasons I love that small games like Dicey Dungeons and SteamWorld Quest and Slay the Spire are opening up people's minds a little bit about this like second layer or like underlayer of game design that happens that is a little bit more like not like mathy, but like numbers driven and like, oh, hey, this stuff is applicable.
And thinking
in a
steps
lot of
ahead
places.
In a way that like a lot of games don't. Like, for example, to explain like how I backdoored into Revelation in like my actual playstyle on SteamWorld Quest, it becomes clear really early on that poison is just incredibly powerful. For one, like especially when you're waiting for the cards that you want, it's useful to have attacks that are occurring passively.
Right, sure.
But it's just does just an incredible amount of damage to the point that it feels like slightly overpowered until like late game where they introduce enemies that are poisoning your whole group and you're like, actually, yeah, this shit actually is overpowered. They shouldn't let me use this on the enemies because it's really devastating to my crew as well. But what I found was that I was and this happened when I was playing last night, where I was like, oh, I have one character who is can cast poison for... So in SteamWorld Quest, for people who haven't played it, the way you accrue points to spend on cards is by... There are certain cards that don't cost anything. And usually there's like a basic attack or something like that, but they don't do anything particularly special. There are also cards that... can like do a status effect and cost 0 points, but you don't accrue a point as a result. And so in this case, I have like my tank, my healer, he's kind of functioning as a tank healer sort of thing. He just takes a lot of damage and also heals everyone up. He can cast poison for 0. But then I have another character who just got a card that can infect everyone with a status effect that one enemy has.
Okay.
And I have another enemy or another character.
You're like moving that status effect to everybody.
Right, so I poison one character. I chain it up with the I forget what the card is called, but the one that expands that status effect to everyone. So like 4 enemies on the screen, now suddenly all they're poisoned. Then I have another enemy or another character who one of the ones that I just got from him is he has a high chance to do a weak attack that confuses everybody for 3 turns. And so basically, like, one of, like, these chains I'm setting up are, like, everyone's poisoned for 3 turns. Now they're confused for 3 turns, and they're attacking each other for 3 turns. And so I backdoored my way into looking at my deck and realizing, oh, I'm running a status effect deck where I'm not actually doing a whole lot of, like, offensive damage. I'm just finding ways to, like, fuck with them through status effects.
Yeah.
And my deck for these 3 characters is a status-based deck that I didn't plan it that way. I just found myself building... Because I guess
right.
because the thing that stresses me out about deck building is like you're just looking at 100 cards and it's like, build a deck. And it's like, okay. Like, I'd rather the game just sort of tell me, like, here's a deck that does this, and then, like, I could tweak it from there. And Quest doesn't do that, but by virtue of just observing the game, realizing, oh, status effects are extremely powerful, not necessary, but they are extremely powerful if you want to go that route, I ended up building a deck that was entirely focused around that, where now that I realize that's my base, I am now just building and upgrading cards that are built around just sleeping people, confusing people, you know, berserkering people, like doing these different status things that sort of allow me to just kind of hang back, like build up my like defensive stats and heal myself and just let everything else take care of itself.
Right. I had almost the exact same thing happen to me in Slay the Spire recently on my current run. I had kind of dismissed the second character, the Silent, after like not really understanding.
Oh, really?
Build.
I love her so much.
And then like I got a couple poison cards and I was like, let's see what poison is about. Because like my first couple runs, I didn't get like nearly any. And I was like, I'm still trying to figure out what exactly this character does. I got some poison setup cards that allow me to build a poison. And poison, like 1 point of poison deals 1 damage in between, like when it swaps from your turn to the enemy's turn. And then it goes away after the next turn.
Right.
But I got a card that gives I got two different cards that really like changed the way that I play that game. One is like whenever I deal any sort of damage, it ups their poison by one. Like any attack. The second one was every single turn, they just gain 2 poison.
Oh.
They're just taking up poison every single. Yes. And then the third was like, amazing.
The key to remember here is in Slay the Spire, poison isn't just set damage. Poison does the amount of damage that the number associated with that poison is.
Yep.
So if it's ticking up every turn it's doing more damage too. So what was the third thing?
The third thing was a card I got. Well, two. Actually, there were 4 things that like made this amazing thing happen.
This
where
combo,
basically, yeah. One was I found a card that was like hold one of the cards in your current hand to the next turn.
Right, that's a good card.
And that
it's like is that a power that you
can
play?
Yeah, it's a power. So like every
for
turn,
that whole fight, you can carry over one card from turn to turn. You can kind of sit on it.
Yeah. Not just one. You could switch in between if I'll pick a different card for this next turn. But I got a card that was double the poison on a current enemy.
Yes.
I was up against this super tanky enemy.
So the champ, was it?
It's like a big knight with just a big sword and like had like 300 HP or some shit. And I was just like, I was like not dealing enough damage with all my normal stuff, but I got all my poison stuff in play.
Yeah.
And I saw the number like ticking up. Like I got it to like 50. He was at 100 HP.
Yeah,
I hit that double.
You're
because I've been holding that double until it got to the right amount of HP. Boom.
That's
it was so perfect.
That's so perfect. Those are the things that are like so good about that game.
Yeah.
Patrick, I'm excited for you to beat SteamWorld Quest, and then I guess Cadence of Hyrule is like a cooldown from card games so you can get to Slay the Spire.
Yes.
I'm so curious how that will feel after SteamWorld Quest. My friend Janine, you're familiar with Janine Hawkins, recently beat SteamWorld Quest, and one of the funny things that she was telling me about it was that it is a game where she historically is someone who's like doesn't like dying in video games, like many people. I don't like to die in video games. That's, you know, fair. But she was saying like she doesn't mind it dying in SteamWorld Quest compared to other RPGs because she could always – there was always a lesson from that death in a way that doesn't always come across in something like Elder Scrolls or Dragon Age where like, oh, I guess I just fucking died. Like, cool, I guess the dragon hit me too hard, or I guess a bandit shot me in the head from across the camp. Whereas in SteamWorld Quest, it's one of those things where you're like, okay – this is her quote was like, okay, I guess he's immune to these status effects, so I'll pull those cards out. And then he's doing a lot of magic, so I don't need physical debuff cards. And that style of like very clearly seeing what the enemy does turned that game, opened up that game for her in a way where she described it to me as being like she understood why people did recon runs on Dark Souls bosses for the first time. Whereas like that is true in SteamWorld Quest from playing it a little bit. It's like, yeah, I go into fights sometimes just to be like, all right, what do I got? And that's 100% the way I play Souls bosses too.
Right.
I think that's really cool opening up that specific feel of like I'm not just playing to win. Sometimes I'm playing to figure out an encounter and then work around it. I know Kato, that probably means a lot to you as a Destiny raider. Raider, where you're like,
oh my god,
this is not The Run.
No, like, it's not The Run.
I gotta learn how this works.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what happened when we did the blind raid recently.
Right.
Was we got to the boss encounter, and like, our goal was not we have to beat this boss. It was like, we need to get to the next phase.
Yeah.
What happens after all these like disparate parts line up, and then what's next? It's just seeing it was like the... like exciting
the
and next step,
right,
yeah.
The reward also in a sense,
exactly.
Right? I'm so curious what you'll think of Seymour Quest as you wrap it, Patrick. So keep us in the loop.
Yeah,
on that.
One thing I'll say to Janine's point is that it makes experimentation and scouting very easy,
right.
And it's not punishing. So the game saves on every screen. So you're constantly like scrolling between.
You don't have to go to a
like,
save
little...
point. You don't have to go to like a.
No, there are statues that you get to usually once halfway through a dungeon or right before a boss that heals up, but also respawns all the enemies.
So they're bonfires, basically.
Yeah, but it's like useful if you want to grind. Like it has all those components. But you don't really need to do that very often unless like you have a specific card that like is really you want to get your healing card up a couple of points. But it seems like this kind of game that actually you could not upgrade any of the cards and it wouldn't make like that much of a difference. It's mostly on the margins. What's nice is like it's very easy to run from a battle. You can always, if you run into an area, you don't like it, you can run out. Like it's just the game is very it's making you focus on the thing that actually matters, mm-hmm. and what it's trying to teach you, which is the actual combat part and learning about what it's trying to, what the takeaways are for the player, rather than all the other stuff also being like oppressive and confusing and scary. It's like all that stuff is very easy, very simple, very forgiving. And then once you get into the fight, like it may whoop your ass immediately.
Right.
But it's always like very good at communicating like where the failure is coming from. Like, you know, you'll get into a fight where, you know, instead of just being poisoned once, like this character is going to constantly cast 3-person poison. So you got to have at least one person with an immunity. So it's the same thing Janine's saying where it's like, it's very, very illustrative. That team is so impressive. They make different genres of games every single time,
yeah.
And somehow knock it out of the park in a way that shouldn't be possible. And yet they've done it, you know, 3 times now. So fuck it. You know, do whatever you want. Make an MMO, I guess.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Is that right? Are they doing that? Is that a thing?
No, they're not.
I'm just saying they pick and choose their battles
like very strategically. Like they scope in a way that allows them to do it, but it's just like they make an action platformer, they make an XCOM style game, mm-hmm. they make a card-based RPG, and it's just like you shouldn't be able to do that like every 18 months, and yet this team constantly does it
every time.
It's very impressive.
Can I give a quick shout out to a mechanic from Breath of the Wild that bonfires reminded me of?
Always, sure.
Blood moons. Okay. And the fact that simple act of like being like, we're going to respawn the enemies, but for a reason and on a cycle, mm-hmm. it's made that world feel that much more alive. And like, just like one of the small things that game has that reminds me of like another game might have just respawned enemies when you came back into an area after having gone away for a while. Right.
Yeah.
And like, this is just like another one of those amazing touches that really sets that game apart from lots of other open world games.
It is, all I'm thinking about right now is Breath of the Wild,
yeah.
So I've been thinking a lot about Blood Moons, I've been thinking about lore implications of Blood Moons,
Oh my god.
Do y'all know about the Tetraforce theory?
What?
I can't get into this.
Wait, is this...
Austin, you should save that for another podcast we're talking about doing.
It's a name given, okay, you're right,
wait,
we should.
Stop. The middle one?
It's not the middle one. That's the thing.
The whole thing?
It's not.
What?
This is a whole other thing.
Oh my god! Okay.
We're gonna get into
it.
Not here. We'll have to consult someone.
Holy shit!
We've been contacted by some experts.
Lore experts.
Hell yeah!
So
oh my god!
We'll figure that out.
That sounds exciting.
We should take a break.
Yeah.
And when we come back,
and
we
then actually do E3.
Do E3. We'll take some questions from fans because we have on some stuff from E3 that we didn't get to, or, you know, questions that they had about it in general. So we will be right back. Enjoy these messages or this music.
Both probably.
Probably both.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And we are back with some questions from you. If you have questions, you can always send them to gamingadvice.com. Not gamingadvice.com. That's not an email address.
Gamingadvice.com. Is there a name for the at symbol?
The at symbol. Gaming, the at symbol, vice, period, com. Oh, C-O-M.
The at symbol is one of our secret names.
See, I saved that one just in case. Check us out
on Patreon. Cut it, Cotto.
Check us out on Patreon. James writes in, Rochester James apparently, writes in and says, hey all, about a decade ago I was at the first PAX East and I played Half-Life 2 Lost Coast on an egg/gimbal mouse alternative, which I think, do they mean the...
The one that's like 3D.
What was that called? Was that the Novant Falcon?
What? The Falcon, damn.
Novant Falcon. Type in Novant Falcon. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Talk about that Novant Falcon.
Novant.
N-O-V-I-I-N-T. Novant. I think that's what they're talking about. That thing's cool looking.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, yeah. They say they played the Half-Life 2 Lost Coast on an egg/gimbal mouse alternative. It was pretty cool, but I think the business plan was half-boiled since I never heard of it again. Did y'all get to see or interact with any control setups or interfaces that were different or exciting at E3 this year? Patrick, you already talked about that cube.
Yeah.
Yeah, anything else? Any other weird controllers? Any other Kencha Hall type shit?
I don't think I saw, like, there's a lot of chairs.
A lot of gaming
really
chairs.
Not a year for it. Even VR was, like, pretty downplayed.
Yeah.
This year.
Yeah, I don't, I think it's lots of gaming chairs for sale. Which is not a thing that I normally associate with E3. Yeah, no, I've used that gun attached to the Novant Falcon before. That was set up in like a Fry's.
It's a picture of a fucking gun.
It's like a gun. It's like a pistol. It's like the back half of a pistol attached to something that looks like it's out of Portal.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't think I had anything there. I think there was some other cool stuff in the IndieCade area, but I didn't try it. There was like another VR game that I didn't play that I think had unique controllers, but I didn't see anything else.
Yeah.
John writes in and says, I think this is a set of haikus.
Good.
Okay.
First one, E3 has ended. How was the vibe on the floor? Consumerism? The second one, top demographics. Who does E3 serve best? Hello, fellow teens. And finally, small developers. Are they lost in all the noise? Rapid montages.
The middle one, I think, only had six.
What?
Is it 5, 6? It's 5, 7, 5. Yeah, the middle one of the second one only had six, I think. Am I miscounting?
Nope. Who does E3 serve
the
best?
Who does E3 serve the best? Oh, how did I miss a word?
I don't know. Maybe we're like E3, one word. In terms of vibe and in terms of the question of small developers, I would say I've been thinking about this a lot. And there are
I actually think it was like probably not bad for them.
100% with
like
you.
IndieCade specifically. E3 is a bad, as it is currently designed, convention for fans. There's just not, we've talked about this before, we're going to completely retry this, but there's not much to do. So, but you're there, you've paid to be there. Maybe you've already done the thing that you waited in line for. You got like a fast pass to Final Fantasy VII. You got 3 hours to kill. You're walking around and you don't want to drink anymore because you've already gone to the 7 different places where they serve beer on one of the halls. Like places like IndieCade are like, you can sit down and play a game in a couple of minutes. There are open kiosks. Like those advantage smaller developers that can offer that by virtue of not being the big brands, the big franchises. And there was lots of really cool shit in the IndieCade section. You know, stuff like Dicey Dungeons that, like, yeah. I haven't played yet, and I wanted to. And so I think there are worlds where stuff like that are advantaged by E3 being in its weird
yep.
place. Not by design, necessarily. It's not as much as where, like, a place like PAX, like, goes out of its way to sometimes prioritize indie developers, like, through its programming. I think there was a situation, like, especially, like, this year where, like, right next to the IndieCade booth is right next to the Nintendo booth. So you had lots of people that were scoping those lines, checking those out, and if they bounced off that, then they were in a prime position to go check out some of the cool shit that was over there. But again, yeah. I feel like that was more like spillover than E3 being like, we think independent development is really important to us.
Do you remember when I was...
Go see the ESA's comments on things like unionization. So, yeah, 100%. You know, color me skeptical.
Remember how I was almost late to our Cyberpunk meeting? Demo. Part of that was that I thought it was in the big booth. I thought it was in their big Cyberpunk booth. And because I was so close to that, I was like, I ran into a couple of fans who I was like, I'm right near the booth. I can hang out and talk to them for like 15 minutes. It's not a big deal. It turned out to be a big deal. But one of the things that they were saying was like how disappointed they were as fans of the of games to come to E3 and like not have anything to do, not be excited by anything. But before I left them, I was like, go to the IndieCade booth. And they were like, oh, we already went. That is the only fucking cool thing here. There's so much there to play. There aren't long lines. And so, like, one, hi to those folks who are listening, probably. But two, there's specifically, that was like a huge difference, which is like, there's cool stuff to play. And yeah, maybe you wait 20 minutes, but 20 minutes is not 6 hours. It's not 3 hours even. Yeah.
And you're going to talk to the developer most likely, right? Or someone who's like deeply, you know, it's the same when people have asked, you know, before E3 opened, it's like, what do I do at PAX? It's like, well, you know, if you really want to go see Borderlands or whatever, like, go do that, right? Like, you should follow your heart and go see the stuff that you paid to come see and figure that out. But, like, if you're interested in, like, chatting with people, like, you know, the PR people are very friendly at those booths, I'm sure. But if you want to talk to developers, people who are, like, doing the nuts and bolts of, like, the game design, like, IndieCade was, like, some of the closest you were going to get to, like, a similar type of thing at E3. And so I would hope whatever that thing is going forward, you know, whether it's at there or somewhere else, is like, it'd be nice if there were like more dedicated areas for stuff like that. I'd love a student showcase, you know, like people that could come up and, you know, what's the booth that rotates? I know there's the, what's the big, the PAX indie booth.
The mega booth.
Right. But so within the indie mega booth, there is then
the mini booth, the micro booth, the indie mega booth.
It cycles out every day. Like there's just new shit every day so they can get more people in there. You know, I would like to see more things like that, both because E3 is its own prestige show, like however it goes, like it holds a certain place. So it'd be nice that people can benefit from that a little bit more. Yeah, there's just more things for people. I literally feel bad. Like, people are spending a lot of money to go to this show, and it's, like, there's not even that much to do around it, honestly. Like, even if you just don't even care about games. Like, there aren't, like, fun things to necessarily... At least PAX is, like,
What are you fucking saying about Shaquille's?
Damn.
I'm saying that do you want to pay for $30 ribs? You can pay for $30 ribs.
Those ribs aren't
going to
be that good. Yeah. Uh-huh. The other part of this is like maybe not tiny developers, but I think like mid-sized developers and especially mid-sized publishers probably come across okay too. I think about something like seeing Empire of Sin, which was the Romero Games like mobster tactics game that we talked about on one of our pods. That's a game that would have gotten lost in the shuffle at a bigger E3 this year than this year's rather. Where if Sony had been there, I probably would have been like, yeah, Rob can go see that. But one person,
or
on
we
that.
Wouldn't have saw it, right?
Or at all.
Like for yeah, like I totally. Like I saw a game like Carry On, the one of the games announced at Devolver's press conference, which was kind of a confusing trailer with a big blobby mass of red. Well, as it turns out, like it's a Metroid game where you're playing like as this monster that like has to deal with like the size of its mass. Like as you're killing things and amassing things, you actually need to, like, strip off stuff of that because it's tied to your abilities, where like the bigger you are, the more abilities you have, but you also shed abilities that you can't do on the lower end, so you're like constantly managing your mass, like hiding it in weird. It's like a really fascinating game that in a normal year I probably would have seen a presentation for The Last of Us 2 instead,
right.
And that would have been the thing where I watched a trailer and like, oh, maybe I'll go see it at PAX. So like that was one of the actually the neat byproducts of E3 was I got to be a little more I'll go see that weird game that normally I just watch a trailer for and actually just go see it and play it and check
totally.
It out.
Totally. So, yes, yeah, so things like Paradox or like who's publishing Empire Sin or even like the people who have booths on the floor, Natsume and like Axis and, you know.
Who?
You know, Axis Games. Is that who I'm thinking of? They like publish a bunch of Japanese games. Like people who do like small, like NIS.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Sure. Yes.
Yeah. Is that NIS or is that
Axis?
I
don't know which one that is, but that was on the floor.
Rune Factory.
Yeah.
Rune Factory.
Natalie was very excited about Rune Factory.
Maybe I'm getting, maybe I always confuse. There's two publishers who I always confuse. Marvelous. Marvelous was the one who was on the floor. Oh, right. X-Seed. Listen, I'm just naming Rising Rising Star. Natsume. Which one is it? Who could say? But that scale, because they have kiosks on the floor where, again, the wait is 15 minutes, 20 minutes to, like, go play something that is coming out this year. Like, that is so much more worth time than the sort of, like, long wait. And, again, yeah, for us, I definitely felt like I saw more stuff. The vibe was bad, though. That show was not great. Next question comes in from Mello. Not our Mello, a different Mello. Who says, hi, after a long E3 work week of coverage and meetings, I often find myself missing smaller fan events that are specific to the things I have, the things I have to remind myself why I love this medium so much. For example, once a year since 2014, I fly to National Harbor for MAGFest to enjoy a giant convention without any advertisements or demos, just fans. The question here is, are there any conventions, gaming or otherwise, that you attend simply to enjoy and not cover? You did Star Wars Fan Fest this year, didn't you, Patrick?
Yeah,
that's a fan. Thing.
Yeah,
you
that
didn't
was
cover
like,
that.
That was a fan thing. Yeah, I like Star Wars a lot. My wife is the Star Wars super fan, and got to take my daughter around and see a bunch of costumes and what she called monsters and stuff like that. Yeah, and weirdly, actually, even for me, like, PAX is that, because I don't cover PAX. Like, I mean, I go there, like, you know, talk to fans, stuff like that, but, like, that for me is, like, a hang-out-and-see-people convention, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I see a lot of my colleagues and friends as someone that works from home that doesn't get a lot of chances to go to events or just casually go get a drink with someone on a Friday. So PAX, like, has post-Giant Bomb, or starting with Giant Bomb, I don't know what it's like to work PAX, and I'm just going to put it in, like, my rider. They're like, I don't work that event. I don't know what that means to work that event. I just go there to hang out
and
have beers.
You see some games and you email those developers later and are like, hey, that seemed cool. Can we get a build? You want to talk about that game now that PAX is over instead of trying to do it on the floor?
I could see, so I don't do a lot of stuff for the kind of thing that the person writing is talking about. I get so exhausted from this stuff. Like, I have almost zero interest in like going to conventions, but I am excited for like, as my daughter gets older and like she has interests, like I could see myself getting very into attending stuff like that that is related to whatever she is into. But like personally for me, like I'm usually kind of done. Like I do enough of them over the course of a year, three is enough for me that I don't need like another one for me personally.
Yeah. I'm kind of in the same space. I have not gone a month without travel this year. I don't think. Between personal.
Well, I guess
stuff
I might get dragged
stuff.
To that. What's the one in August that I might go because you're going to be out near me?
Gen Con. Are you going to come out to Gen Con?
Gen Con.
It's
maybe.
Indianapolis.
I couldn't go myself, so I need to get approval from the family. But
you should.
Indianapolis is not that far away.
Yeah, you should come through. I'm going there for Friends at the Table. We're doing a live show, which is exciting. But also, so yeah, every month this year I've gone somewhere for either work or for travel or for personal stuff.
Right.
Or at least since February. No, all year. All year I have. Now I'm thinking about it. Because I did like that talk out in California. Uh-huh. Then we did PAX stuff. I did some other personal travel. I went out to California for Judges Week. Then again this month for E3. There's a chance I'll be in Toronto next month for a couple of days. We'll see. I just got an invite to do a thing up there. And then after that is Indianapolis. And I'm just like desperate for a fucking month to myself where I don't have to think about a plane, where I don't have to get onto a plane, or I don't have to get into a bus for 12 hours or whatever. And the other half of this is like it has become weird to go to some of these conventions to some degree where – I do want that anonymity. I wish I had a secret thing that no one knew about. Like I wish I was like deep into pizza ovens and I could go to PizzaCon and like no one
Does
there.
That exist?
Yeah. There's a pizza convention. Yeah. There's multiple pizza cons. I know someone who was just at a pizza convention. There are different types of pizza cons. There's like retailer focused ones, and there's also like chef focused ones. Anyway,
Pizza Con Illinois.
Things to get my daughter into, so I have an excuse to go. Pizza. But I wish I did, because it can be. I've talked about on over on Be Good and Rewatch It, a great podcast in my opinion. 5-star podcast, 5-star runtime. Still going. It's still going in my heart. I talked about being an introvert over there, and that's not a thing. I think someone wrote in a letter that was like, well, you know, for me, I read the character of Mr. Darcy as an introvert, which I guess isn't something y'all would understand because you're all pretty extroverted. I was like, no, not at all. Like, the fact that we talk into microphones for a few hours a day does not actually mean that we are extroverted in that way. And in fact, for me,
I can get up in front of a panel, yes, and pound the table and be an outwardly performing person.
Yeah.
And then when my wife and I are going to dinner, I feel like acute stress about like going up and talking to like the person to like just get a table.
Yeah.
Like, like that's just like, you know, it's not debilitating stress. I don't want to like overblow it, but like I can get up and like be in front of 1,000 people
and
not
put on
blink
a Sora costume.
Right. And you would, it would not be like wild to like think a logical extension of it as like, that's just every day. And it's like, No, it's like, last night my wife was like, can you take Jessica down the street so she can like go play with the neighbors? And I was like, I don't know. Like, you mostly hang out with those neighbors. Like, that is like stresses. I don't really want to do that. And it's like, so it's like, that's like the delta between being performative.
Yeah.
And
there's such a distinct difference. Well, and for me, the big thing is when I'm in those situations, I want to be on and I need to be like Austin. Right. I can't just be. I have to be Austin Walker. And I like doing it. It is a role I like playing. It is like,
oh, it's a lot of, it's fun to be someone that is not,
right,
your more anxious self
exhausting.
In some ways.
It's so, for me, it's even less, like, I'll do all that stuff. I will go talk to the server. I will go to like my family dinner party and like do my best to be as on as possible and like have engaging conversation and like be involved with everyone's life. And then I get home and I am like, I can't talk to a person for 2 days.
Yeah.
I got back from E3 and all I wanted was to like sit in a quiet room where no voices existed for a week. Like, I'm still like, I'm going to finish this call and then I'm probably going to go home and work from home for the rest of the day because I can't stand the idea of being in an office where people are still.
Yeah.
And so conventions are already like that for me, where like, even a day, even doing stuff I want to, like, I signed up to a bunch of shit for Gen Con, which again is a big tabletop convention where I'm like, I'm going to play the Battletech tabletop game. I'm going to go do Battletech pods. I'm going to like play some indie RPGs and stuff like that. And I know I'm going to have fun, but I'm already exhausted. Like, I'm not looking forward to that trip at all, except to like see my friends,
right,
because I know it is just going – because it's been a long year already. I know it's just going to drain me, and no amount of fun in this moment is going to counteract how exhausting it's going to feel.
Right.
And that makes me a grump, and I know that. And like, but when I'm there, I'll just turn it on. It'll be fine. It'll be 100%. It'll be great. But yeah, so it's hard for me to like get excited about those sorts of conventions. And then doubly so if it's the sort of convention where like – I'm going to be, and I don't want to, I'm not saying this to say don't say hi to me at conventions. I like meeting fans. It is rejuvenating.
That's why we're there.
It's been cool at E3 to run into people who are fans and be like, hey, let's catch up really quick. Like, tell me how the show is going for you, all that stuff. But it is still more draining. I have to put out more of the battery on that stuff.
Right.
And no one should feel bad about doing that. I'm there because I've decided in this moment I want to put out more of that battery, but it is exhausting. So
yeah.
I take my quiet time where I can get it most years. Kato, do you do any convention type stuff?
A lot of them.
Yeah?
Well, I mean,
I'll say Kato immediately after going to LA was like, I'm piecing the fuck out of here. I'm going to go play some magic at a comic shop.
That did happen. That did happen. That was so funny.
It just happened to be
lying.
A pre-release weekend.
I thought there was a bit being played on me when I landed. I was like, where's Kato? And he's like, he's at a comic shop. I was like, oh, okay, I guess it's like a slow day. He's like, he's playing magic. I was like, the fuck? Like, okay, I love it. Like a friend? He's meeting a friend? Nah, he just looked it up online.
Yeah, well, it's a pre-release weekend. These sets come out at set times, and there's the weekend where everyone comes out to play it. So, but yeah, no, like, I've always been going to conventions. Mostly, like, anime has been the ones that I, like, attend the most, and then comic book ones, like, when there wasn't an anime one near me. for a while there, like when I lived in Baltimore, it was Baltimore Comic Con, and every once in a while we could make scrap together enough money to do KatsuCon in Washington D.C.
Cool. Yeah.
But like here, I try to hit up New York Comic Con every year, and now Anime NYC. I'm trying to go to it again as well. And like part of the things that I really actually love about those conventions is when they get when it's not non-industry panels, which are on really interesting topics, like things that are like these are fans kind of talking about the things they love in certain ways, or like you know, panels on like are you interested in queer stories by queer creators in anime. Like here's like a list of things that people don't talk about or know about. Like,
but these exist,
right? Like things like that that are like really cool and interesting, and
totally.
Like
and aren't just buy our shit,
right? Exactly.
Yeah.
Or like even when it's like creators that are working within the industry, like but they're speaking like there was a really cool last New York Comic Con I went to a year ago was. One of my favorite panels was the Latinx in Marvel panel, which was just like all cool. Like a seven Latinx creators that work in Marvel comics, but they were talking about their experience within and outside of Marvel and how Marvel operates within this space of, you know, like they're introducing more people of color, like superheroes and things like that, and like the like struggles of being that creator and like not getting picked for X project when you probably like when they like it's that thing where like corporations will not always pick the right people for something that is meant to be about people of color, right?
Like absolutely,
and all that sort of stuff is like the best parts of those conventions for me. So
yeah, that makes sense to me. I spent years going to like anime conventions and comic cons when I was in high school, then especially in college,
right?
With friends and stuff, and like splitting hotel rooms and all that shit.
Yeah.
And like, let me tell you, the drama just got to me. The scene drama was too much. I'm dead ass serious. It was like you couldn't go to a convention without it being like breakup season.
Yeah.
Without it being some shit was happening.
Or hookup season.
Or both.
Yes.
Let me tell you, Patrick, those two things are often directly intertwined.
Day one, hookup season. Yeah. Day three, breakup season.
Uh-huh. 100%. And often not with the same people.
Right.
And that was always part of
See, that's the thing.
Problem.
That's why oftentimes I could never afford to actually travel for cons, and it would always have
local
to be in local cons.
Yeah, you go home to your own bed.
Yep,
and you good. Let me tell you, there's no excuses.
No,
there's no excuse. Listen, I know my hotel is only next door, but I'm so tired. We're already here. Let's just stay here. It's no big deal.
No.
Go walk across the skyway. Go back to your room. Don't make any mistakes.
God.
Put the Jack Daniels down. new question. This one comes in from Matt, who says, would you all be able to talk more about Astral Chain, Daemon X Machina, or Phoenix Point? I don't think any of us saw Phoenix Point. Neither Daemon X Machina.
One, what's that? Phoenix Point?
Phoenix Point is the new tactical RPG by... what is his name? Why am I blanking on his name? The original creator of XCOM. Gollop, Julian Gollop.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. It is like XCOM, but with more like Lovecraftian aliens. And
gotcha.
It's like the quick and dirty pitch. I didn't see that. I know that was there in some capacity, but I didn't see that.
Huh.
Daemon X Machina was not playable on the floor, as far as I know, nor was it behind closed doors at Nintendo. They did a good couple of Treehouse streams. The thing that I'll say about that, which I think I already maybe mentioned, was I like how they are addressing concerns from the prototype that they released. They released a prototype earlier this year, and they're like actually addressing some of the concerns that were brought up with that,
cool.
Which got me thinking about that as like a light early access model.
Right.
The idea that they actually – so they released that demo in February. And in my mind, I was like, this is a demo. This is going to be the game, like outside of, you know, some small stuff. But when you look at the list of stuff that they're changing based on feedback from that prototype, it's the sort of stuff that changes after an early access period.
Right.
they would never call it that, and it was free, you know, and in some ways it's like preferable to like buy into an early access game.
Yeah.
But there was a degree which was like, wow, cool. Like, that's okay, cool. There was a story trailer for that that is complete nonsense last night.
Great.
Just, it feels like a marketing team got 12 cutscenes and they were allowed to take 7 seconds from each cutscene and just stitch something together. And it's just a proper
noun. So like a typical like NDA embargo from a Japanese game publisher.
100%. So yeah, I was like, whatever. But there's a lot of, it seems like there's a lot of story in that game, Daemon X Machina. So sure, Astral Chain was also not playable as far as I could see. But I do know.
A little surprised given the fact that was coming, you know, it's coming in late August, earlier than I suspected. I'm very excited to see how that, like the mechanics of that actually work, because the Nintendo Direct, man, it made it look. Was there a Treehouse actual demo of?
I don't know.
That game.
Let's see.
Astral I would Chain, like to go back and watch Treehouse. It if that was
Me
true.
Me too. Yes, there were two. There were two of those, in fact.
Shit.
Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
It's like an hour of footage on that. So we have to go back and watch that.
Damn. Gotta go back and watch like, all the damn Treehouse.
The Treehouse, like, let me tell you. I love the fucking Treehouse. Yeah. I watched the Fire Emblem Treehouse thing.
Oh, shit.
That game looks so good.
Fuck.
That game also not playable on the floor. Fire Emblem here, or not Heroes. What is it called? Not Fates. Three Houses?
Oh, no. The
Three Houses.
Sorry, I thought you were going backwards.
No. Three Houses.
Yeah.
Looks like entirely my shit. The fact that there's like a time jump. The fact that there's like, you start as a professor. I cannot wait to just completely.
Wait, I didn't realize this. Astral Chain is an upcoming action video game developed by Platinum Games and published on Nintendo for Nintendo Switch. It is directed by Takahisa Tara, who was previously lead game designer. Designer for Near Automata.
Wow. I didn't know that connection. The thing that people have been asking us to weigh in on is, surprise, police, cops.
Right.
Astral Chain is a game where you fucking play as someone who has police on their chest. You are a cop. And this actually, one, my expectations are low with this regard.
Sure.
I watched that trailer that was in the direct did give me some vibes of like, wait a second.
There was like, secrets, hidden, and it, I guess if, you know, someone related with Nier, maybe there is like a reason to suspect there may be some subversion at work. But I think you are right, Austin, that is the right attitude. That
low expectations.
What is Platinum known for?
Uh-huh.
Like, they are known for exceptional gameplay. Hell, the whole chain mechanic might feel like really weird if you start thinking through the implications of that based on a lot of places they could take the narrative of that game.
That is the thing that I think that they'll end up being like, the chains are actually bad. In the end, we have to free them and work alongside of them by their own will instead of chaining these astral demons or whatever.
You'll find one demon that's like, I'm cool with this.
I'm good with it or whatever. Who knows, right? But the police thing, I don't know, did y'all see the Chris Plant interview with Tara?
No.
Should I just read this section?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. So
who's the interview with? The guy
with Tara.
Tara?
Yeah. Okay. Who is the lead gameplay designer. Plant over at Polygon asks, in the United States, playing as a police officer in a video game is complicated. Our country deals with police brutality and police shootings. I recognize in Japan that the police are very different. Can you tell me what the perception of the police is in Japan and how a Japanese audience responds to playing with the police? And Tora says, let's see. Well, I don't think that there's people within Japan who have an extreme view on the police department, which is definitely not true. There are definitely people in Japan who have strong feelings about the police.
There's one person
somewhere
we can find.
I promise you there is someone out there wanting the abolition of police in everywhere. That is not an unthinkable thing. Through this game, we want to give the police the image of being a hero. You can't do things in this game like hurt people. We want to have the player feel like they're being heroic as they progress through the game. Also, I think it'd be good, too, if you generally have a negative image of the police, but you play through the game, that your image or opinion of the police changes as a result of playing this game.
Ooh.
Finally, developers are out here saying what the politics are.
I have trouble even, like, generating any anger at that statement, too, because, like, what else did I expect?
Yeah.
This is 100% in line with my expectations of a big name developer not understanding what Plant is getting at here because they don't know what the. I'm not surprised by it. Do I wish there was a different answer?
Yes,
absolutely.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not trying to like lower the bar as a way of just like absolving my desire to play what is probably like a really good like game feel video game.
Yes.
It's more just, you know, I think one of the things we've talked about this 3E3 especially is like wait for that game is like engage with the work.
Yeah.
Like,
that game's gonna
like
come
the,
out.
That kind of answer.
Yep.
Right, like, and then I can talk about that, like, how did my feelings on its depictions of police run up against my, like, love of the gameplay, right? Like, and that's, like, a much more interesting conversation. Now, that, again, like we talked about, don't let people off the hook, but at the same time, recognizing the limits of what we're going to get or, can receive in terms of, like, interesting answers, accountability in the access-based like gaming interview cycle that a lot of this stuff comes out of. And like when the game is out and we can judge it on the terms that it is, then it's like, that's like a much more interesting conversation. I'm glad that questions are being asked, right? Like I'm glad that
same
asked
shout out. Yeah.
Like,
that is the moment to do that for sure. 100%. I also,
even if you get a BS answer, at least the BS answer is on the record.
On the record
and in some ways that informs how we interpret the work when it comes out.
Right. The other half of this is the idea for me. The other thing there is I'm not an expert on crime in Japan or on policing in Japan, but I will say that it does allow, once you have that answer on record, you can go like, okay, well, wait, what is the state of policing in Japan? Because I do know that it is not as simple as like, well, the police in Japan are cool. Everything's fine. Like the specific stuff that I'd always read is that like, not always read, but recently have read is that the lower crime rate in Japan has not been met by like a de-escalation of policing or like the amount of police is still high,
right,
and they find things to do. And sometimes that means attending to crimes that were previously ignored, which is like things like sexual harassment and things that were like deprioritized for shitty reasons.
Right.
But other times it's like over, you know, a more intense anti-drug, you know, policies and enacting those sorts of policies in ways that are not necessarily like useful or productive and are often like maybe a little too intense for what's being done. And so like, you know, do your own research on that. But I what I will say is like it is never as simple as like, well, the police are good there.
Right.
In the same way that like whenever I hear people talk about like giving Japanese games a pass on their queer representation because, oh, it's just different over there in terms of being gay or trans, which happens all the fucking time. Like, it is as if there are not queer folks in Japan who are actively already, like, doing the political work to make their own lives better.
Yeah.
To fight for more rights and to fight for, like, a better relationship with Japanese culture. Like, that stuff is happening, and it is ridiculous for us to, like, hand wave it away as like things are just different, even though at the same time, what we shouldn't do is pretend that there is like when I read this interview with him, I'm not surprised that he isn't up on Japan or on American policing and like the situation there. So it's about finding that proper like balance between holding someone accountable for what we do know is happening in their own backyard. And also if they're going to sell games globally, there is a degree to which I think there should be a degree of like recognition in the same way that I want to hold accountable Activision for its depiction of stuff in the Middle East. Like, even though we're not from the Middle East, like there is a degree of accountability that we should think about. And it's just like, how do we find the right fit for that?
Yeah.
You want to do one more maybe? Talk about one more quick cue. let's see here. Luigi writes in and says, hey y'all.
Luigi,
great name. Ludjy, pronounced Luigi.
Would be a convenient.
They write, "How cool is Luigi?" No, they don't. They say, "Hey y'all, I was wondering how y'all felt about the reemergence of JRPG games like Trials of Mana, and Romancing Saga at E3, and what that might mean for the genre in the next gen. Did anime finally win E3? I don't think it won, but seeing those games in the direct was really cool.
Yeah.
I've been thinking a lot about this morning. I spent a lot of time thinking about, I don't know why I got in this hole, like answering a question that no one asked.
Oh, here
me.
We go.
Thinking about, I do remember why. Someone sent me a picture of something that was like, a creepy grain silo, basically. And I almost wrote back like Silent Hill TK, TK, TK. And TK in media journalism talk means to come. Like it's, well, I'll fill in the details later.
Insert later.
Insert like, later, hey, basically.
If you're like pre-writing a story, it's like the Metal Gear Solid 5 is coming out on TK, TK, and then you fill that
you
in
fill
when
it in
it's
later.
Announced.
And then I realized like, the phrase Silent Hill to come is like the most terrifying thing. I don't want Silent Hill to show up.
No.
Go away. And then I was like, well, then in my own mind, I'm like, huh, I wonder when we're going to get another Silent Hill game. And I was like, well, someone would tell me that we're never going to get one. I'm like, they're wrong. We're going to get another Silent Hill game. Konami is going to sell us a Silent Hill collection within the next three years.
I saw that new Contra. I don't want a
me
new Silent Hill game.
At all.
Stay away.
But eventually,
stay away.
Eventually, they're going to fucking sell that portfolio.
Yeah.
Within the next decade,
yeah.
Either they're going to invest in games again, or someone is going to give them a check big enough that they get to be the ones who bring back Silent Hill.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking about the Konami, the Contra collection that they did this year, and then the Castlevania collections that they've been doing.
Which, those seem really good,
but,
actually.
Well, and then I was thinking, why are we getting all of these retro things right now? And are they going to sell them to us again in 5 years on the next set of consoles? Are they going to make us relicense it, depending on backwards compatibility and stuff like that?
Yeah.
And part of me was like, well, maybe the reason we're getting a lot of these things right now is that, like, they are the install base on these consoles is fairly big, so they know that like the Switch is sold very well.
Right.
Like, hey, we got enough people who own this thing where if we put out Romancing Saga and Trials of Mana, people will buy it. They would not have bought. They would not have happened on the Wii U. The Wii U. Not enough people had that for there to be a subset of people who would have bought Romancing Saga. So I think like,
it's also the case that like. There's been a lot of communication from all the platform holders that,
yes.
Like, you're good. Like, there is going to be forwards compatibility. We're looking at these platforms as things that don't, like, we may be, like, the kind of world where, like, okay, maybe even local compatibility disappears, but, like, cloud-based compatibility, like, continues, like,
in
you
some
know,
way.
Far into the future, where it's, like, you can feel pretty reasonable, like, if you buy Super Mario World for the billionth time, like, at least this one you'll probably have for the next 10 years
mm-hmm.
before
right.
you'd have to buy it again.
Yeah, and so I think that, like, I think it's cool. I think it's, I'm excited for it. There's a lot of games there that, like, I never played, and having those available is neat, even if I'm still not playing them yet. There are so many JRPGs. There are so many, and I want to play them all.
I think Square, like, put out a statement this E3 that was, like, they're, like, taking a real big look at, like, the historical record and, like, want to digitize and get everything, like, their
Good.
Whole, the goal is,
they should.
Like, to eventually have their whole library available, which would be neat because it's like, look, have a base level.
Aren't they the ones
Chrono Trigger, Final Fantasy VI is available, and then do your rematch. Like, make me pay for like the cool shit. Like, do something interesting with it, and then I'm happy to pay again. But I've been well past the date of wanting to pay for. You know, it's just so easy to get that stuff elsewhere and in easier ways. Like, just
was
go ahead, Kato.
Was it Square that I recently saw on Twitter? Somebody say that they like. Would delete their source code like after a game shipped?
I mean, that's go look up the history of Japanese game developers.
Right.
Like, so source code management is bad
yeah.
in general, like in the, you know, 70s, 80s, and even 90s. But yeah, like the running theory on like FF8, like the reason it hasn't been in collections, the reason that it's taken this long for them to do anything is that they lost the source code.
Oof.
And so to remaster that game, to do anything with that game, means to build it all over again.
Wow.
Which is one of the theories for why
yeah.
even other obscure Final Fantasy games have gotten, you know, some, like, love. And even though Final Fantasy VIII has always been seen as sort of, like, kind of the strange one of that PS1 bunch, like, it's beloved enough that it should have gotten re-released in ways that it has not.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's, like, absolutely true. Like, I think it was... there was some quote I saw from E3, and it might have been from a Square, maybe the same interview where this quote about like getting their whole library up was like one of the games they were porting. The only reason they were able to then bring it along was because like they called up all the developers, and someone had an old computer in their basement where they found
wow.
the code. And like that's like the degree to which there has been such poor
that's
preservation
wild.
With
yeah.
a lot of this shit. I may be misattributing that to Square, but that actual like sort of story is like you can find that a million times over, which is why, you know, I mean, I think just for E3, Motherboard put up a piece about like, you know, the preservationists who are going after like the stuff on Ouya, which was a garbage platform, but had some cool games on it that a lot of them did come to other platforms. A bunch of them didn't. And that stuff just fucking disappears unless people do the work along the margins to find that shit. And then you end up, that ends up helping developers later that didn't do the work themselves.
Totally. All right. So here, Patrick, Kato, is what I think we're going to do. We're going to call this podcast over, but then we're going to record a second question bucket only podcast because that is how many questions we got. And I've looked through many of them now. And they're like, fuck, I want to answer that. Fuck, I want to answer that.
Shit.
And we ran out of time on this one. So we're going to stop this one. And then you can come back later this week for the follow up.
Yeah.
Question bucket deep dive. So
the deepest of dives.
Shout outs to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Find out more about that. Waypoint.zone.
Oh, right.
/BOEN. Bowen has a new soundtrack out, by the way.
That's cool.
I think because Lovely Planet 2 is coming out.
Oh, nice.
Lovely Planet is a really cool, like, arcadey first person shooter with a great soundtrack. So check that out. Kato, where can people find you on the internet?
At @A_Kato_appears. Trying to remember where I saved Bowen's music because I've been using that Christmas.
Christmas is over.
Stuck
baby.
In my head. Game like I was already imagining the like outro music playing under this bit.
Different type. Patrick, where can people find you online?
You can find me at AlienCon this Friday at the
Do
Los
a panel
Angeles
or
Convention
anything?
Center.
You
yeah,
don't. You can't
one.
Say.
We'll see if
you can't say. That's spoilers for the people
oh, you're
buying.
Right.
That's true. Sorry. Yeah.
You have
yeah.
to buy the $7,000 edition. God.
We've been doing this wrong. We could just charge more for shit often.
Yeah.
Damn.
You know? Yeah. I. If only.
Do you want to see our personal editorial calendar? Then
our new Patreon tier. All right. You find everything we do, twitter.com/waypoint. You can go to vice.com/games or waypoint.vice.com. And as always, you can also go to facebook.com/waypointvice. No idea if that page is still updated.
It is.
That's good.
Yes.
Shout outs to the social team for updating that page. Yeah. We'll be back later this week.
Wait, YouTube.
YouTube.com/waypointvice. Shout outs to the incredible video team here who not only put those videos up from some of our streams last week, but also started doing little excerpts of some of the key conversations. Like, you can, if you just want to look at our conversation about Breath of the Wild 2, you can just pull that up, which I think makes it easy to share. So people should go find those and share those. And again, shout outs to everyone who made that possible on the back end here. And also just shout outs to the video team here who have been real supporters of us over the last couple of months, who have like come out of the woodwork. Both the video and the media tech teams, actually, who both come out and been like, we think y'all make good stuff. I wish you were in a place to make more good stuff. And
we also
want to get back to streaming and doing more video stuff. And with their help, we've been able to do at least a little bit. So shout outs to them. All right. That's going to do it for us this episode. We'll be back later this week with more from the question bucket about E3, the future of gaming, small questions like that. Stay tuned. And until then, peace.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Let's do a time that is. Let's do a 43. Unless you don't have it. You don't have it. You don't have it. That's fine.
If I had 44, I could have had it. I was just, I needed one more second.
Let's do 52. Okay. Kato, I know you're a big fan of Destiny.
Yeah.
Did you know that destiny is not a matter of chance? It's a matter of choice. It is not a thing to be waited for. It is a thing to be achieved. Says William Jennings Bryan.
Is that about power level?
Yeah, it's about power level. You have to go out there.
I gotta go get that gear.
Get that gear.
Raise your power level up.
I still want to call it a light level.
I still say it all the time.
Light level is more interesting. Yeah, exactly. Say it out loud. All right.
But I guess people were confused.
Yeah.